Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial.
This podcast was brought to you by LivePerson.com. LivePerson.com, a world of experts.
Well, hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Here we are again. Thanks for joining me here, episode number 88. And we're kind of closing in on the end of the year, end of 2008. And I think for most of us, it is probably not too soon. The fact is that none of us, I think, have anything else to say but, wow, that was crazy. And it keeps on getting crazier every single day. So what I thought we'd do today is spend a little time talking about some of the news and some of the things that are going on and then getting to my guest today, who is Charles Bitterman from Trim Tabs. He has some really neat things to talk about. We're also going to talk about the dry bulk index. Received some questions on that last week from a couple of listeners, actually. And we put up a post on that at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But also Kevin Hoffman, my lead portfolio analyst and lead trader, is going to be talking with us. You'll meet him. I don't think you've met him yet. And I'll bring him out to kind of talk about some of those things. And but I think, I guess probably one of the biggest issues right now to talk about, I mean, we just can't escape it, right, is this whole Bernie Madoff issue. I don't know if it's affecting you or anybody you know, but this sure does affect a lot of things in the future. And whether it's affecting you right now or not, I think that you're going to see some things and some fallout. Let's start with a few things. Number one, first of all, the big question is, how did this happen, right? I mean, how did $50 billion just poof? Just disappear in thin air. I mean, when you think about the gravity of that and the incredible amount of money, right now, maybe we're a little desensitized. We talked about this. We're a little desensitized to this word billion and trillion, frankly. But billions of dollars is an extraordinary amount of money. You know that. But I don't think the real impact of how much money we're talking about has really filtered through the entire system yet. Because number one, we don't really know how much money was obliterated. Number two, I think because of the general shell shock of where we are now, it's very difficult to really understand, you know, just how incredibly dramatic that is and what does that mean. So if we think about the $50 billion for a moment and we say that, well, this $50 billion that's not going to be invested anymore and it's kind of out of the markets and it's really been removed. Well, really, maybe wasn't there for a long time anyway. Needless to say, it is a substantial amount of net, wealth of people that won't be being spent, and that just once again causes us to take pause and think about what the effect on the economy is. You know, down here in Florida, South Florida, there was a dramatic amount of movement this weekend and stories and in the paper and on TV. Because Bernie Madoff had his tentacles into all areas, but none so great as really the Palm Beach Country Club, as well as many of the country clubs down the East Coast and of South Florida and New Jersey, as well as into New York, of course. But what's interesting is the amount of people that were snookered by this were, you know, people like, not only the charities and the individuals and the sophisticated players, but beyond that, it was the smart money, supposedly the hedge funds. And the hedge funds of funds are going to see a major beating here on this, and it goes incredibly deep. Now, what I wanted to really focus on here is what's going to happen in the future, and how do we really deal with this? Well, I think the first thing is that there's going to be a lot of people pulling money out of hedge funds, and we're going to continue to see extreme flow of funds out of investments as people lose confidence. And that's why today's guest, Charles Bitterman, who really tracks all this, is going to clue us into that. We'll talk to him about that. But I think that when you look at the net effect of this, I think that regulation is going to step up into the future, and it's going to be just incredibly shifting. We're going to see that tide turn from an unregulated and an environment where we didn't see much oversight to just, shifting 100% the other direction. The other thing I want to mention to you and to talk about, which is outrageous, just completely outrageous. This week we had the bailout, or at least the temporary loans to the auto industry. And I don't even know if we should talk about that. And I don't know how you feel about that. But, generally speaking, that's troubling because it doesn't create anything more than more of a mess moving forward. More of uncertainty because what we have is only maybe a 2-month reprieve at best. We're still seeing cars and automakers really have a substantial amount of unsold inventory, and it's just going to continue on. But the most egregious and the most disgusting story of the week, besides Madoff, besides the auto industry, is, and aside from the fact that oil, look at oil. You were here when we were talking about oil at 140 or so being crazy and all the reasons with the Enron loophole and all the things, but there is a study now that is showing that about $1.6 billion of the TARP and of monies that were utilized for the banks went to pay out bank executives in terms of their overall bonuses and overall structure. And $1.6 billion was, we're talking about cash bonuses, stock options, things like use of the company jets, chauffeurs, country club membership. 600 executives were taking this kind of money in a time when they were losing billions and billions of dollars. How does that make you feel? We saw the announcement that Goldman was cutting down. I think it was about 50% reduction down to about, $275,000 on average per employee for salary. Now, I'm not crying for them. I know you're not crying for them. But when we look at this situation where Goldman and companies like Morgan Stanley, Citi, Capital One Financial, wow. Richard Fairbank, the chairman of Capital One, he got hit by about $1 million when his company had a disappointing year, but he still got a $17 million, he got the stock options. And at the same time, the company took $3.5 billion worth of TARP money. John Thain from Merrill Lynch, he took $83 million in earnings last year. That was last year, okay? But when we look at the bailout and the situation with Merrill, they lost $7.8 billion last year, and while he's only getting $57,000 in salary, he also had a $15 million signing bonus and an additional $68 million in stock options. Wow. Merrill took $10 billion from taxpayers from the on October 28th. How do you feel about that? The Bank of New York, Robert Kelly, he had some money he took also. Well, he had a salary of about $975,000 and a $7.5 million bonus. He had a car, and his driver cost him about $175,000. And he received about $850,000 relocation expense allowance when he had to move from Pittsburgh into Manhattan. I mean, it just goes on and on. It just goes on and on. You know, J.P. Morgan, right? Jamie Dimon, he ran up $211,000 in private jet tabs. And, of course, they took a $25 billion funds. Shall I go on? I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And now, hold on to your hats here. And now, Paulson, amazingly, is going to ask for the next $350 billion. Now, if you've been paying attention, you've watched Neil Kashkari get just stripped down and just tar and feathered and just taken down by Congress recently. He's the assistant to, he kind of looks like Mini-Me, doesn't he? Did you ever see Kashkari? You know, I'm going to try to find a picture of that. I'll put it on the website. But Kashkari and Paulson, kind of like a Mini-Me and Dr. Evil kind of thing going on there. But but when you look at what has gone on and the lack of, we'll say not oversight, but the lack of any kind of transparency and the lack of any kind of tracking of where the money has gone on, it's interesting that he's going to ask now, right now, while you're listening, sometime in the next week or so, he's going to ask probably for this $350 billion. Why? Because Congress has to approve it or disapprove it, I should say, within a period of, I believe it is of 2 weeks. Now, if Congress is no longer available, they have to call a special session in for this. I mean, this guy is tricky. This guy is really, really tricky. So now all of a sudden, where many of the people on especially in the Senate had said that if he comes back for any more money, they will fight with everything they have to stop this. And he's doing it in a really interesting way, come behind the scenes to do so. And now there's going to be a big fight again, and who knows what that's going to cause the stock market to do. I'll share with you this, that while we had moved, I think I mentioned to you, we had moved into many of the quote-unquote Obama-style infrastructure development stocks, the Caterpillars, the AECOM Technologies. We even picked up some Archer Daniels Midland. And when you look at those stocks have done so well lately, you know what? I am not sitting on them. We have sell stops across the board on every single position where we are just not going to sit idly and wait for things to happen, because you can't do that in this market. This market will turn on you in a split second. Now, one last thing before we get to our guest here, I want to mention that in last week's Strategy Lab, I wrote a couple of different pieces. We're actually creating a calculator to work on Fibonacci retracement levels for this kind of edge strategy, where hopefully if you pick up a little bit of volatility, you can buy on the outskirts or the edge of the range of a position and catch it and take it on the up. If not, of course, get stopped out and be careful not to let that loose and let that really run away from you. But in the Strategy Lab, I talk about the Archie Bunker portfolio. Right now, it seems like a time that bunkers, I'm talking about, canned food and rice and, potable water. But bunkers are in the minds of people. Like, where are we going here? So we wrote a piece called the Archer Bunker Portfolio that gave you the acronym. We used Archie as the acronym to find out, how can you protect your portfolio now? I encourage you to take a look at that and utilize much of that if you haven't done so already. Because right now is still not a time to be extremely optimistic, even in the face of an $800 billion or a trillion dollar bailout / stimulus package by Obama. It is a great idea, but think about it for a second, folks. If he implements that right now, this exact moment, right now, how long is it really going to take to trickle down to the economy? And at what risk? And how long do we have to really sustain this level of pain before it really starts doing anything? A lot of people are talking about it really not doing anything at all anyway. So all I'm saying here is we need to exhibit a good level of care and at the same time, keep our sanity and a reality check overall. I also went back head-to-head with one of the gentlemen on Strategy Lab. We actually redesigned the site recently. People told us it wasn't that easy to find it from our site. So if you haven't done so, go check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We redesigned some of the links and some of the blog roll and updated a few things to make it a little bit easier to navigate. But John Reese over at the Strategy Lab, he's a buy and hold. I mean, truly buy and hold mentioned, as a matter of fact, I think about a month and a half ago, that no matter what happens, he will have a fully invested portfolio. Well, that's fine. And he argues that when the markets recover, those of you who have been, you know, timing the market and investing and trading are not going to catch that big up that always seems to come just when you least expect it. But you know what my answer to that is? That's fine. You know, whereas a portfolio that has been buy and hold maybe down 35% and we're up 5%, let's say, or 2% or 10% or even or down 2%, whatever the number is, who cares about catching the up? We didn't have any of the down. Good news is we can catch that ride anytime we choose without any worry, because a 35% differential is enough, and that's pretty good. So with that, let's step back and get our next guest on the line. I think you're going to enjoy him. I've been chatting with him a bit. I get his updates, and his information is something you really need to consider, because does it in a much different way and gathers information in terms of flow of funds and employment that probably you haven't seen before. So we're going to take a listen to him. We'll be right back with Charles Bitterman from Trim Tabs just in a second. Hold on. You're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm David James. I'm an expert to the world
in spirituality.
There are millions of experts who are brilliant in the kinds of things everyone needs answers to.
Hi, my name is Larry Doan. I'm an immigration lawyer in Los Angeles.
Now you can chat with them live, online, and benefit from their knowledge.
Hi, I'm Jamie Parker, a public relations specialist and an expert to the world on liveperson.com.
There's a world of experts on liveperson.com. Chat live. It's free to start. Liveperson.com, a world of experts.
And welcome back. This is Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and we have a special treat. We have a gentleman who is the founder and CEO of Trim Tabs, Charles Bitterman. He's the guy that you see all the time being quoted by Barron's and New York Times on TV. He's the gentleman who really studies the information, more so than just taking a look at what's the percentage of employment that we have right now and how many jobs are we losing. He gets behind the numbers, so I'm very pleased to have him today. Thanks so much for joining us today, Charles.
Good to be here.
So let me ask you something. So you put out a great piece recently on the unemployment rate. You know, everybody thinks that the unemployment rate is simply that, you know, we have to look at, oh, how many people don't have jobs, and we take the you know, at face value, the information from the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and whatever they throw at us, however wrong it may be, it seems we just seem to love. But yet you do something a little bit differently. You look at payroll numbers, which is a much more exact and more real-time, I would say real-time, look at what's happening with the payroll in our country, right?
Well, not necessarily payroll number. I look at withheld income and employment taxes that the government collects from all employees with jobs. And that number is plummeting. That number is indicating is down, believe it or not, 11% over the last 9 days. And I've been tracking this for over 10 years, and I've never seen a decline like this. This is horrific. This says that December is a big month for bonuses, seasonal hiring. This says that there are no bonuses, there's no seasonal hiring, and that lots of people are being laid off. Our guesstimate is, if you back out what we think, you know, at least a 50% decline in bonuses, that we're shedding over half a million jobs a month. I mean, this is horrific.
So let me ask you, so how does that track out to BLS, because I've also read some pieces, and I've written some pieces that have discussed your findings on the BLS studies, which pretty much you've debunked and shown how inaccurate they are, because I think that you and I have talked before, and you've told me that basically it's kind of a random number they're throwing out there that they hope is right, but then they'll worry about it with revisions later.
Yeah, it's 50s technology in an online financial world. They do a survey of 400,000 businesses, and the initial respondents in the month that they report are big companies and the government, and so a few smaller companies, and so they extrapolate from that to the entire universe. We look at income tax collections, which is real-time data on the entire employment universe. So first 9 months of this year, our estimate of job losses was twice the estimate of the BLS, and after BLS revisions, we're now 9% apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our estimate for November job losses was about 400,000. They reported 530. We actually think that they're now reporting more job losses than actually happened because there was some major layoffs at big companies, which they do get data from. So they're extrapolating big layoffs to the entire. So not that 400,000 is any good, and we now think December is over 500,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not off by that much, given what's going on in the economy.
Well, that's interesting. One of the things in the economy that I find fascinating is what's happened lately is the numbers have become so enormous, almost in everything. You know, 500,000 jobs, $4 billion loss, $1 trillion backup.
$50 billion stolen by one guy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so we'll get to that in a second too, but I think we're a little desensitized to a lot of this. So what we see, you know, you see a jobs number come out in the 550s, like, whew, at least it wasn't 575 or something of that. You know, is that something that's going to wear off soon? Is that something that's a phenomena maybe that because we're just a little bit entrenched in some of that? I mean, because $1 trillion, my friend, that's a lot of money. I mean, seriously, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, do you remember the days when only a couple of years ago, if you said the company lost $1 billion, what would happen to that company?
Yeah. Or rather, the classic quote, Everett Dirksen, I think was his name, was a senator from Illinois who had said at one point, 1 million here and 1 million there, and soon you have real money.
Right, right, right.
Now 1 million here and 1 million there is not real money.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It really is. So do you think that these numbers, I mean, they're going to wake up? I mean, Obama has put together this theoretical economic recovery, at least that's, you know, this is what he's banking on right now, unless they're working on something in the background. But basically, we're going to have bridge builders and pipe welders and pavement layers, 2.5 million people back to work. But by the time he actually, even if he does this very quickly, by the time it's implemented, we're going to have another 2.5 million out of work. So then we're going to be already at, still at 7%. And today, some gent came out from somewhere and talked about that we're going to be probably at an 8% unemployment rate in the next month or so.
Well, we have there earlier this year, there were 136 million people on payrolls, and we've lost about a couple of million off of that, and we're going to lose another the next year, probably 4 million, 5 million people at the current rate. So we're going to lose 5% alone this year. Add that to the prior payroll job loss number or unemployment rate, and it's double digits.
Hmm. We're going to move quickly. I have so much I want to talk to you about. I want to ask you about flow of funds. My recollection, my introduction to trim tabs is always the, you know, mutual fund or the flow of money into the markets out. That's, I mean, you know, where I kind of, I guess, my initiation. So tell me a little bit how you track and what's going on with inflows in terms of, let's just talk about the markets, equity inflows, mutual fund inflows and things of that nature that you're tracking.
Good point. I was just watching CNBC earlier, and they had Byron Wien on, who's talking about some nonsense that the Bureau of Economic Analysis put out recently, that there's a positive savings rate. Now, unfortunately, the Bureau of Economic Analysis does not track savings flows. They track that number is their estimate of income, and they subtract from that the Census Department estimates total spending by the entire economy, and subtract A from B, and they have some number, and that says that's what they consider total savings. In point of fact, there's no money going into savings. We track money going into all savings vehicles, and it's horrific. $450 billion came out of equity funds, bond mutual funds, hedge funds, and some amount of money is included in that direct selling of stock. $450 billion since September. We can only find $200 billion that went into savings vehicles, bank savings, small certificates of deposit, and retail money funds. In fact, $120 billion went into certificates of deposit, which are timed deposits, which is not sideline cash or not something sitting there.
And not waiting and chomping at the bit to get back in.
Right. So like $450 billion came out. There's only $100 billion like in ready assets. That $100, you know, where did the rest of the money go? Well, we think it went to pay bills. The other phenomenon in a flow of funds arena, a year ago, over $30 billion a month was still coming out of real estate. That $30 billion is the cash over the mortgage on the sale of a home when a home was sold, and also the cash portion over the mortgage on a refi, cash out on a refi, was about $30 billion a month. Now it's about $3 billion a month. In other words, there's a lot less money coming out of real estate, and where are people who are still spending, getting the money to spend? They're selling stock, and that's taking money out of the bond market. We're seeing mammoth outflows from bonds and stocks, and we're not seeing money going into other savings vehicles like in the past.
Well, so I mean, the more you have of this crazy market movement up and down on a daily or an hourly or on a weekly basis, the less people are going to desire, because, you know, it's one thing having a big down and a big, you know, that October slam, that November slam, and then saying, hey, you know, I'm looking for a bottom here, because everybody always wants to find two things I find. One, everybody wants to call the bottom. Two, everybody wants to say they found whatever this capitulation is. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece recently, and we put the word capitulation in there somewhere in a piece for MSN Money Strategy Lab, and the title that the editors was, you know, we found the capitulation point. And frankly, it was November 21st that it went up, so it looks really good for me. But that's not what I intended, okay? I'll be honest with you. That's not what I was thinking about. You know, it was just kind of the concept of we're closest. But everybody's always looking for this, you know, on TV. Everybody wants to be the person that called the market. Everybody wants to be the person that called the bottom, you know, because somehow it brings you all sorts of fame and glory, right? But the truth is, you and I talked about this, that the hallmarks of a bottom, okay, if it is so important to find, and because everybody knows that from a bottom doth fortunes be made, right? So what is the problems? You were telling me earlier, what are the problems with this current market design as compared to what would be a real market bottom?
Well, historically, at market bottoms, companies and insiders are buying back shares, you know, by the bushel load. In 1988, after the 87 crash, there were outflows just about every month from mutual funds, but companies were shrinking the float, they were buying back shares, there were cash takeovers, insiders were buying. In 95, that occurred, in 98, in 2000, and starting in June 2002, we saw enormous amounts of company buying and insider buying. Right now, it's not happening. Cash takeover announcements are down over 90%. On the London Stock Exchange, they report stock buyback announcements are down over 90%. Cash takeovers are non-existent because the canceled deals are greater than the new deals. So there are no cash takeovers. Stock buybacks in real time on the London Stock Exchange are down 95%. Year over year. That's not indicative of insiders thinking that there's a bottom, and they certainly know better than you or I or Byron Wien or the traders here who think that there might be a bottom. And point of fact, insider buying is at a two-year low.
Now, that's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of controversy over insider buying. You know, I would like to think that, yes, insiders do know when to buy or sell their own company. They know when things are going. But, you know, there's been a lot of studies that have contradicted that and said that insiders really have no edge.
Well, insiders, I mean, you know, all the studies that have been done look at one point of, like, they look at buybacks, they look at insider activity. But when the float is shrinking, the market goes up. Mm-hmm. When the float is growing, the market goes down. That's always happened. Mm-hmm. It can get trumped for a period of time by flows. In other words, you know, when I talk to individuals, I say the stock market is a casino, and the house and the casino are the public companies. You walk in, you give them your money, they give you shares, and say, now outsmart us. So when they've been buying, the market historically has gone up pretty much all the time, and when they're selling, the market pretty much goes down. Right now, the float is not growing that much. In other words, there's not that many more shares being created, but not because there isn't desire by companies to sell shares. GM would sell as many shares as they can at any price.
Mm-hmm.
Citicorp would sell a lot of shares. There are a lot of banks that would love to sell shares. There's just no demand for those shares.
Right.
The other thing that's of interest, you know, there's some insider buying services that say, well, the sell-buy ratio is bullish because insider selling is not that high. But what they're missing is that in the past, insiders were given shares of stock to sell. Now they're given options. But guess what? All those options are underwater. So insiders have nothing to sell. So
yep.
Not that they wouldn't be selling if the stocks, if they had options to sell.
Right.
But those options, they can't, are not saleable. So they're not selling that much, but they're buying even less.
Right. So I have to get to you about mutual fund flows. I want to talk to you about that. You know, TrimTabs, by the way, if anybody hasn't heard, go to TrimTabs website. I think that you'll, there's a lot of good information on there. You'll see TrimTabs everywhere. You know, they're always quoted on all the different areas. But we'll put a link, of course, on the website.
Not as much as Andrew Horowitz.
Oh, well, naturally, of course. Thank you for recognizing that. I appreciate that. listen, so you said something really great. I mean, really, it was a cool statement. I thought it was really cool. We were talking earlier, and you said, when people were buying houses back when, you know, when it was actually chic and when you admit to buying real estate, or boast for that matter, people weren't really buying real estate, were they? You know, it was equivalent to, you said, it was like they were buying an option on real estate versus buying the property. So, you know, putting in the equation of a stock, you know, stock, you own the principal and you own the certificate, you own the piece of the company, whereas if you own an option, you have a derivative. You have an option to buy it. You have an option to sell it. Take me through that.
Well, in 2006 and 2007, people were buying homes at over the value of the house because they didn't have to put any money down. And not only did they not have to put any money down, the more interest rate on the mortgage they were was less than was below market, and in many cases below even rent. So people could have an option, live in a house they couldn't really afford, paying less than what they would pay for rent for that house, and if the house went up in price, they got, the option expired with value.
Right.
And if the house didn't go up in value, by the time the mortgage, the teaser rate rolled over into a real rate, well, they just walked away, and yeah, they got their credit got dinged, and it wasn't pleasant, but the only ones who suffered really were the lenders and those who sold those packages. And it's actually the sale of those packages that caused the coronary artery disease that the financial markets are suffering from, and why they're stroking out
right. Is
all those packages that are, nobody knows what's in them, they can't be sold. And then the brilliant, the unforeseen consequence of bankrupting Lehman in the middle of September created a cascading effect of securities being dumped on the market as Lehman was bankrupt and all their holdings were unwound. And there was just this horrible, if you track the economy the way we do, and you see withholding was slow, the economy was weak and sinking a bit. And then mid-September, it just, went down like a rock.
So you're not in favor of the whole, obviously, what happened with Lehman. I mean, whether or not we look back and we could have done something different, it's what it is, right? The Bear Stearns thing is
what happened was horrible, and it created dumping of securities. And in a mark-to-market world, meaning that bank assets are valued at the market price, and if the assets that Lehman held, the billions of dollars in assets, were dumped, were forcibly sold, and there are no buyers out there, so prices got marked down. The main problem, why banks aren't lending and why all that TARP money is sitting in treasuries, is that bank capital is impaired.
Right. So when you look back at that, one of the things that strikes me is that during that time when the Bear and the Lehman, Tim Geithner was very involved in that, wasn't he? The new Treasury secretary to be. Are you in favor of his appointment?
I don't know enough
to
comment. Right. I'm hoping he's doing a good. He's capable, and for all our sake, I mean, people make mistakes, even well-intended, very smart people, and I think the Lehman bankruptcy was a mistake. I don't know if they could have, avoided it. I think they could have, but I don't know enough. And
yep.
it's, uh,
So let me skip over real quick. We'll take two more minutes. One on I want to talk about Madoff for a second, but I want to talk about mutual funds. So I've been of a frame of mind for the last couple of years that you know, especially when I got a little bit more comfortable with ETFs, generally speaking, that I said, well, you know, what's the point of a mutual fund at these days that they can't seem to move? They're like a giant beached whale, and you know, they're just being poked by these bears right now, and a big dead salmon on the beach, so to speak. And I don't really understand what the point of a mutual fund is now. I mean, there's a lot of them. They all kind of do the same thing.
4,000 equity funds and 5,000 hedge funds. And combined, that's 9,000 money management operations managing equities. And there are only 3,000 stocks globally with over $1 billion market cap. So there's more individual money managers right. than there are companies to invest in.
Right.
A triple.
Yeah, it's just crazy because, you know, then you have so many people trying to just benchmark the S&P, which I don't know whoever came up with the S&P as the benchmark, but it is. And whether it's good or bad is not the point. It's just this arbitrary point.
Sure.
And, you know, we all believe in it. It's like kind of the emperor's new clothes, right?
And, there's no question that there are some people who can outperform the market and managing mutual funds, a handful, not that many. And those people, you know, do a good job, but the vast majority of mutual fund and hedge fund managers underperform.
Well, generally speaking, they have the cards stacked against them. You know, they have their hands are tied. There's too much. Listen, take one of the biggest Fidelity Magellan Fund. I don't know where it is exactly today, but the day that I saw Fidelity Magellan Fund, and it wasn't like I was looking for it and tracking it, but I happened upon it just, you know, one day that I saw it was down 50%. I almost threw up. Seriously, you know, there was a bigger discussion there. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, well, the assets under management by equity mutual funds are down 50% from the peak at the end of October 2007. So the industry is declining, is shrinking. There will be mergers of funds consolidating, families pulling them together to cut costs. And it is a shrinking area, as are hedge funds.
Mm. So I guess we'll get right into hedge funds, Bernie Madoff. But I have a question about hedge funds. So you got let's just pretend there's a bright guy at the helm of a hedge fund, okay? And let's say that for whatever reason, that bright guy didn't happen to see the problems approaching or something of that nature, okay? I'm painting a story here. Now, at the same time, he didn't see it, but it started happening.
Uh-huh.
Tell me why they couldn't get out. I must be missing this whole point.
Why a lot of them did.
Yeah, but a lot of them did way too late. I mean, we're talking about hedge funds down 30-40%. What kind of hedge funds down 30-40%? You couldn't maneuver out?
Well, those who were down 30-40% were those who were trying to game it and play it and played wrong. There are a lot of my clients who are down 10-25% who didn't see it coming and or were not convinced it was going to happen and have gotten out. And you know, look, a guy who's done well over the years loses 20-25% one year. It's not the end of the world.
I agree. I'm with you. No, I mean, it can happen at any given time. I agree.
And there are a lot of them who thought they could outsmart it, and they were down 40-50%. And those guys, you know, they dug their grave, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, look at some of the mutual funds. You look at Lake Mason and some of those guys. All right, let's finish up on a discussion of, you know, this horrible situation with Bernie Madoff. You know, classic name. You know, I love a... you know, you took a look at doctors' names, and we can name some funny ones out there. I had a friend named Pete Moss one time, and, you know, we have a guy named Bernie Madoff, as in Madoff with the cash. I mean, smart guy. Went to, what school did he go to?
I don't know, but he's probably a very smart guy.
Yeah, he went to a school I think that you're familiar with.
Had gotten away with it for so many years.
Yeah. But seriously, I mean, you know, I don't know. What do I know? But I don't think he was a bad guy always. I think the fractions to decimal system and maybe some of the things kind of got away from him and all that. But, I mean, we're talking $50 billion, we're talking $25 billion, we're talking a tremendous amount of money. I don't see it hitting the markets in terms of things. I'm hearing we're down here in Palm Beach, where we're in Fort Lauderdale, but I'm hearing today that people one week later are selling their apartments, they're selling the condos, they're selling their chalets. Charities are closing without any information about really what's going on. What's your feeling in terms of whether or not he did it or not? Let's forget. Let's move beyond that, okay? How he did it, let's even move beyond that. What is the effect on the markets? Are you seeing any kind of movement? Did you see any kind of hiccup the day after, the week after, anything that you're seeing in the markets in terms of that?
Well, it's just more indication, I mean, of a lack of confidence in the markets. You know, but the one question I do have about the Madoff situation is I don't think he could have lost $50 billion with the strategy he was employing. It just, there's no way he could have lost that much. My suspicion is that money still exists somewhere.
Mm.
It wasn't a Ponzi, classic Ponzi scheme. The money didn't go out, a classic Ponzi scheme. I mean, the early investors, their gains were marked up, and many of those early investors gave him more money. So it wasn't like he distributed, like the original Ponzi scheme, they gave money back. I don't think a whole lot of money went out. And so, I mean, more than that, I can't say. I just, it's pure conjecture on my part. I guess I may be a very cynical New Yorker.
Well, I'm from New York, too, and I'm just as cynical, I'm sure. But let me tell you something. The whole thing is weird. Besides the fact that it's horrible and all that, I'm not talking about that side. It's a little weird. I mean,
it's very, very strange. And I think, you know, it sounds like a novel. We're in the middle part of some esoteric, strange novel or some movie that, you know, we're watching the middle part.
Right, exactly. And all of a sudden it turns into a cartoon in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
the resolution could be very strange.
Right, exactly. Well, Charles Bitterman, I really appreciate it. Again, founder and CEO of Trim Tabs. And I highly recommend anybody listening to check out what he's, you know, his tracking of his mutual fund flows and various employment numbers. And we will direct them directly to your website.
Thank you for the kind words.
Hey, thank you so much for being here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
I've enjoyed it as well.
So recently we got a letter in, actually an email in, asking about what was called the Baltic Dry Exchange. It's kind of an index that gives us a little bit of insight into exactly what's going on in the shipping routes. But I thought we'd do is bring my lead analyst in. His name is Kevin Hoffman, and I thought he would maybe explain a little bit about that. So, Kevin, tell me a little bit about what is this whole thing about this Baltic Dry Index or the Baltic Dry Exchange that you hear recently, especially, been hearing a lot about.
Sure, Andrew. Evaluating the impact of infrastructure spending by President-elect Barack Obama and other nations is not something that's easily accomplished. We could take a look at the performance or demand for commodity prices, maybe infrastructure development stocks, or even stocks that provide things such as steel, cement, and machinery. The problem with those indicators is controlling the idiosyncratic or even specific risk inherent with one specific company or commodity. The answer to our question, though, may lie within the Baltic Dry Exchange. Now, the Baltic Dry Exchange is an exchange similar to like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the Board of Trade, or even the NYMEX. And they maintain a marketplace of shipping routes for the dry bulk cargo. The Baltic Dry Index is a price-weighted measurement for the general cost of shipping or receiving those raw goods. This index may give us some foresight into the increased demand and possible indications of infrastructure spending affecting the whole total global marketplace. This exchange is made up of member companies that ship or intend to receive cargo, and unlike stocks, it is completely removed of speculative players. Economists seem to believe that this may be the purest leading indicator, as the demand for raw goods generally will precede the demand for those finished goods. When companies begin demanding shipments of these raw goods, then the Baltic Dry Index will tend to trend higher due to an increase in the number of vessels for shipment. This index peaked around May 30th of 2008 at just over 11,400, and the levels that we're looking at now we're trading at in the low 800s. So this is a rather significant drop. This extreme shift in demand that began after May 30th was a good indication of where the market was headed. A decrease in the demand of these raw goods from China's build-out and exports from the United States' weak dollar came to almost a complete halt. If this index begins to trend higher, then this may be a good sign of some economic recovery.
So that's great. So tell me something. How can we actually find out more about it? I mean, what's the best place to look for information on this? And I think you actually put a chart up that's kind of interactive on this.
So a place that we can find out a little bit more information about the Baltic Dry Index is we can visit our website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we have a chart available to see this dramatic shift in prices for the Baltic Dry Index.
Well, you know, so tell me explain how someone would use this, and maybe give an example of you know how we did this recently for our clients in terms of in our portfolios and the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy.
Well, unfortunately, the Baltic Dry Index is not something that you can invest in a direct manner.
Okay.
But one of the ways that we've been able to accomplish profiting from this index is by purchasing some of the shipping companies such as Excel Maritime, mm-hmm. Dry Ships,
right, Dry Ship,
or
yeah.
C-SPAN shipping companies.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Excel in particular we bought, I think, down in the fives, and we sold it in the mid-sevens, and that's a pretty good gain, about a 50% gain in a matter of only 2 or 3 days. This index showed that there was just a slight amount of growth or something happening, some rumblings, and we took it and really ran with it, and realizing that this is probably not going to be a long-term play. But when we saw that happening, particularly in the areas of the Asian markets, that it seemed to be something that a lot of people may be picking up on and going into. And because these stocks have been just totally obliterated over the last however long it's been, it was really a great play. So thanks, Kevin Hoffman, lead analyst for Horowitz & Company, and for that information. If you have a question, of course, you can write into us. Just send to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll get to it as soon as we can. Now, that's about all we have for today. We're going to mention that next week we have Peter Schiff, who wrote the book, what's called The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets. A lot of calling for them. A lot of people had written me and asked me to please get him on. He also wrote the book Crash Proof. I think it's going to be pretty interesting to talk with him. In the meantime, I hope that you have a good week. We're going to have a lot of updates. Follow me on Twitter, by the way, Andrew Horowitz. We do put some important updates from time to time. You get immediate releases of our items on the disciplinedinvestor.com. They come directly through Twitter and through Facebook, frankly. So if you have any questions on that, of course, you know where to find me. And keep a look at the site. We're going to have, I think, an interesting week ahead or next few weeks ahead. And there's some really cool videos that we're going to push out as well for you. Well, that's about all we have. We'll see you soon. Have a happy holiday. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Hopefully there's going to be a little stock certificate with a lot of opportunity in your stocking. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.